Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed poets Diane Coy Gwynn and Cindy Jung Oak discuss their craft, presented by the Poetry Foundation. This program originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to our final program here at the Partner Stage of the American Writers Festival. The Poetry Foundation presents these next two award-winning poets reading from their work and discussing process, themes, techniques, and more. A poet and multimedia artist, Diana Coy Gwynn, is the author of Ghost Of, from 2018, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and Root Fractures from 2024. Her video work has recently been exhibited at the Miller Institute for Contemporary Art. Cindy Jung Oak is the author of Ward Toward from the Yale Series of Younger Poets and the translator of the forthcoming English translation of The Hell of That Star by Kim Hi-soon.
All right, hi. Thanks for being here. Cindy and we're like, who's gonna be here? We don't even know. We'll just hang out, you know, so this is really lovely to see your faces. I'm really grateful. Cindy was the one who, put this festival kind of on my mind, and so I'm just going to acknowledge some folks who enabled for us to travel to be here. So Allison, also Carol, Noah, and just, the Poetry Foundation. We're both from California, where we are kind of residing right now in this moment of convergence, but previously we were kind of closer to the East Coast. I don't know why I'm telling you where, you know, we're just all over the place. All right, I'll just read, I also am terrible at showing the cover. I just read and then I hide. So it looks like this. Okay. This, I was just describing to Cindy because I'm teaching at UCLA where I think there's a lot of outrage and sorrow happening because they're on a quarter system, so classes are still ongoing, and there isn't really acknowledgement of the brutality that's been going on to the community and the encampment that was forcibly removed. And I was literally just showing Cindy, so I'm just visiting for one quarter. I know, I said I was going to tell you more stories, but my email address is the same from when I was 17. And then I was like, I'm not going to do my name. How boring. And at the time, I was really obsessed with, the fae, which is, another word for fairy. And so my email is literally, this some Gaelic word for fairy, and that's still my email right now. This is related. I'm going to read a poem that I revised. I wrote it in grad school when I didn't write about anything related to the Vietnamese-American experience. And then I kind of came back to it right before this manuscript got put together. And I was like, it's so white. Because I'm writing about Selkies. I know. See, this is all related. I told you, the British Isles. And I was like, let's put myself in there a little bit more. So, and I think the original, or the earlier version, does exist out in the wild. I think it was published by Devil's Lake. And I think that's a Milwaukee journal. Anyway, you guys can tell me. I'll Google it to figure it out. Selkie weaning young. Finding her hide, we trailed fingers down, then against grains of fur, thrusting shoulders into its waxy skin. This is how she found us. The past draped about us like a cloak. Hands twisting peach halves from a core. Her form in the sound, a pandan leaf peeking through milk. The only seals in Vietnam, American men with green faces. I was kind of avoiding it, but I ran out of things to watch because I'm, my spouse and my toddler, they're across the country. And to be distracted, I watched all the things that I wanted to watch, which is weird. I hadn't had time like that in so long. And so I finally started watching The Sympathizer. I'm just bawling. It's a satire, but I'm bawling watching the kind of scenes of people in the Saigon airport, which is the airport where my father also fled, and I know his story, and I'm seeing like this other story, and I'm just like, but to see it embodied and to see those explosions and the people who don't make it, it's really terrifying. And so there's a series here that I chopped up throughout the book, and it's called Misinformation, and it charts my mother's family, chiefly my maternal grandfather. Misinformation. Spring. A woman in suede pumps takes down every painting, revealing ghosts on the wall where frames used to hang. Files rent in thin white strips, falling like ash, curl along embassy corridors. A man adjusts his glasses, packs a satchel, the click of its buckle like a voice choking behind closed doors. He walks the same way home, gathering his family, the way an open palm sweeps stray grains of rice into one corner of a kitchen table. The Americans offer to take us with them, he says, though he doesn't know why. His children do not know what he has seen. They wake and sleep to blooming bombs, whistling missiles. War, an instrument whose sound is absorbed and amplified in the body of a girl, like mercury inside a fish. We are winning, my grandfather says. The South will not lose this war. I don't know if anybody's watching or had seen or read The Sympathizer, but I thought about my grandfather in the character of, I guess, like the colonel, because he's just like, yeah, we're doing it, but it wasn't happening. Okay, so there's a kind of two sequences in the collection. They all have the same name, because I think all the work is kind of connected anyway, and the phrase for the name is, the title is Doi Mui, and it's a period of economic reform in Vietnam in kind of like the mid-80s, which is around the time that I was born, but it kind of started a little bit earlier unofficially. But whenever I saw it or heard it, because my relationship with the Vietnamese language is, I don't know, I think the words I've used previously is feral, but it's like its own brackish water, you know what I mean? And so I would always mishear it, and I thought it was something else. But I feel like I just actually had a professor from my graduate school just text me today saying he's learning Vietnamese, reading this book. Also, like, I don't know why he's texting me that. But anyway, and I told him, I was like, because he said he was mispronouncing, and I said, you're actually pronouncing it correctly, because I don't actually know how to pronounce everything, and so whatever you're doing, that's actually my experience with it. But if you want a link to the audiobook, is what I said to him, I'll send it to you. Because they gave me 3 free links. So if you want it, let me know. Because actually I had a Vietnamese teacher like scold me like this, you know, over Zoom as I was reading the audiobook. Now, I don't know why I'm telling you all this. Okay. Doi Mui. At the site where the wound will occur, we know that she was in the garden, the one she had cultivated, seed by seed, shortly after moving in with her husband and their 11 children, all of them together again after years of separation, her husband and son's feet in America, her daughter's and hers in Vietnam, first in Saigon, then a place unmentioned by the coast, underground, in hiding, waiting to make a successful bribe so they might board a vessel, any vessel, collective bride in dark waters facing an unknown stage. Boom, boom, she whispered to my mother. Butterfly, the word my mother used to reference our genitals, 2 cupped wings like a heartbeat. Boom, boom. In hiding all that year unmentioned by the coast, my mother as a young girl had her first period, its dark liquid unseen in their nest underground. Boom, boom, the smear of red between my thighs perfectly symmetrical, 2 lips pressed together, as if to kiss or to strike. I feel like it's more fun to tell you guys stories in some ways, because the poems take me to a different emotional space that I don't always want to be in that space. So I think the banter, if you'll forgive me, can be a palate cleanser just for me. But also, I like to give you, like, the metadata, you know? My mother always referred to, like, a vagina by that phrase, boom, boom, and but I also know that word for butterfly, but I didn't know how to spell it, so I just using Google Translate, you know, and then I would, like, cut and paste it. And this is how I know my mother was Googling me, because this got published, I think, on D. Van's Diasporic Vietnamese Artist Network's kind of, like, their Diacritics kind of online journal. And the next one time when I saw her, she doesn't talk about, like, oh, what I wrote about her family and her sisters. All she said was, like, there's no accent on the first boom. But I know what she's saying when she's correcting my grammar. You know, like, there's so much that goes unsaid in our family. And then this is live breaking news. So my spouse was chatting with me this week over FaceTime because he finally opened these Vietnamese kind of kids blocks that a friend had gifted us. They were so nice, so we were like, let's not open it yet. And apparently the block for butterfly, it's only one word, boom. So I'm like, is boom boom just like what my family says? I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, who knows what's butterfly, what's vagina? I don't know. So it's my relationship to the language is evolving. And these are things that Google Translate cannot tell me. And I say this out loud because there's always somebody who speaks Vietnamese in the audience and they'll tell me more stuff. Okay. Just gonna read two more. One is called Cape Disappointment. You should look it up. It's a state park in Washington State at the opening of the Columbia River, and I spent time there walking it right after I got my first COVID shot back in, I guess that's 2021. Cape Disappointment. Nausea arrives like showers sweeping the sandbar, toes edged at the jetty. How our bodies move us and how we move our bodies. How do middle-aged orphans fight over their mother's funeral rites? By watching a bruise form where a brother has touched. The unexpected flush of beach strawberries early in the season. Okay, so we haven't talked explicitly yet about the title for this, Forms and Fissures, but both Cindy and I also work with forms, but sure, like forms that other people like that have long traditions, but also forms that kind of arise from our own meditations and engagement with family history and our own personal history. And so one form that I work with is the photographic archive within my family. That's just people keep asking me, like, what do you mean by archive? And I was like, I don't know, just like shit in a box from my parents. But if you call it archive, you sound fancy. But it is an archive. And every year on the anniversary of my brother's suicide, I revisit these photographs where he had cut himself out of 2 years before he took his life. And this one particular year, I was really fascinated because I was like, oh, the whole time I've been like fixated on the void of where his body had been. And I didn't notice, like, that's his shoe. He left his little shoe in, you know, and I don't know, that like really tickled me. Or like bits of his like left fingertips. So then that got me thinking about who's left in these photographs. What do I remember about those people, younger versions of me, my mother, my father, my sister. So I'm just gonna read, this is a piece called Beside. I'm gonna read the fragment and then I'm gonna read A Familial Body. Beside. I left this in. He who shoots the photograph has been here all along, standing there beside us in the nick of time, having arrived just after triggering the clock. One solitude stands beside others, capturing this moment for posterity, for he himself, a man named Sung, whose son removed himself from frames, cutting into them and all around, two clocks nicking the wire, the vanishing wick. Quick, everyone say. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Diana. I think that was great, especially to talk so much about email, which I remember well because I'm born in the 90s and I used to do like the email chains where you have to put your favorite color and you know, like all these kind of emails, and they always felt very additional to your life. Now it feels like my life is email, and sometimes I get a little break. I get to go on a walk. And so when I was in college, and it did start to feel that way, that email was getting more and more sort of the expectation of like always being on it, and like it is your name, right? It's not like this sort of character you create, or you call it your favorite, I don't know, fruit or character or something, but it's like you, your Gmail. I was getting these emails from my mom, who was trying to connect with me, and I've been thinking about my parents a lot because they met in a student protest and they fell in love in this sort of backdrop of like being imprisoned and being beat and like all these difficult moments, and that was when they were you know around 19, and I was 19 and I was struggling and I was hospitalized, and my mom was writing me these emails being like, you know, and I was, by the way, like at like a fancy college and sort of like, you know, I think that year I didn't even have to work. But my mom was like writing me these emails being like, being 19 is so hard. I you know, it was hard for me too. And I'm like, well, it was hard for you for like a different reason, like maybe a more real reason. But it was her way of, you know, wanting to connect, wanting to empathize. So this is a poem that takes, there's a couple of these in my book, and it takes work that she sent me and then adds line breaks, so it's a sort of collaboration, and maybe I wish that she could have more credit. I know it's just my name on the cover, but of course my name has, you know, my family's name in it. This one's called How is Temperature in East? We leaving tomorrow. Call me to say bye, I love you. Be lazy. You deserve it. I am so exiting, thinking Santa Barbara trip. We had gone, you were 4 years old. I didn't know I will be this age and feel tired, so easy, and keep forget everything. You are in your precious times, but don't forget, you will be my age and regret things. Don't try to do more thing or care too many people. How cold, I hope you walk underground. Path, sometimes cold wakes us up. In Korea, I like winter. Pretty much, I like desire for surviving more than any season. We were hungry, too. Good luck. How is your feeling? I will pray every morning for you. Sorry that I am not good mother, who you can share everything. But trust me. I love you more than I had loved you. You are so mature to understand old analog emotion. I want to say sorry I didn't share enough your pain when you are that young. Thank you for get over your special difficulty. I love you, and strange to say, I respect you. This century is too dry. I'm happy you have emotion. Don't skip any meal. If you miss, you can't get meal forever. I just tell you that you have strong will to overcome this situation. Don't forget, you are a million times precious than money. I hope you had a good day. North Korea, so terrible. We will send more corns next month. I have heard your cousin cried on her 30th B-Day last week. You guys didn't say to her, bad sisterhood, send her something, e-card, etc. So my partner grew up here, and I used to live 3 hours away, so this was like the humongous city that we would try to make it out to. And Do you remember in spring 2020, there was a study about COVID in the poop particles? Like that the poop sprays when you flush it and then the particles go into the air. Oh, I was so stressed out when I heard that. And I had to travel to, because of this family emergency. And so, you know, I was so upset, but I was like, had my N95, I had my glasses, and I was like, I'm not gonna poop the whole trip. So I wanted to poop before. And I was also really nervous. You know, I was like leaving the house for the first time in a few months. And so I pooped on the side of the Chicago, of the highway, with like the car guarding me. It was so gross. And so that makes its way into this poem. And I've never had reason to share that particular story, but it's local. We have to acknowledge the highway. The thing that's weird, sorry if you're squeamish, but the thing that's weird is that then, you know, I came back and then in 2021 I had to travel again. The same thing happened. At the same time, before I was going to the airport, I had to go again and go on the side of the road in the same spot. And I was like, it's becoming Pavlovian, like this is my spot. And then we even went back another time when I didn't have to go to the bathroom just to look at it and marvel at the roadside and how the dirt swallows our waste at the end. Think of the mushroom, soaked and near dissolved, of the shrouded smile at the terminal, or the fish whose stripes appear only on cooking through. Think through the thrown tantrums and basketballs, the berries unpicked in a heat wave, or the yawn interrupting itself. Think on the photo, unglossed at the crease, the orchid outlasting the graveyard visits, the leavings of the resolute sticker, and even the invited weight of an awning or a title. To think about any being, summon a kind of waste, about the glassy dress shoes on the connecting flight, the veins memorized in illness, the temporary cover for the grand and sleepless windows. Fold each thought word to word, the highway stop where toilet paper is piled, sorry, the knife marks on the counter with the ants carrying earwax, the wooden enclosure for a lake, flooded, the hum of the cobbled after party. Think. I think that one of the exciting things about poetry is the form and the fissure that we get to kind of play with and also push on, right? You're always sort of questioning yourself. I have a cousin who used to paint, and she used to say, you know, why are people always talking about painting? The whole point is that there's nothing to say. Like, if I could say it in words, I would have said it in words, and it would have been way less expensive. And the great thing about poetry is that you can use words, but then you have all these other resources, too, to kind of do what can't be said. I have a strangely high pain tolerance. And so there have been times where, because I wasn't aware that something was going on, I sort of went too late to get stitches or whatever, you know, to address the issue. And so it's not a positive, but it's something that I've thought a lot about. And this is a poem called Fissured, about the fissures that we have in our bodies that we forget to acknowledge, and also the fissures that can be beginnings instead of, you know, instead of wounds. Several of my bones have splintered or separated and been left to heal incorrectly on their own, mostly in childhood. Of course, the analyst believes this to be symbolic of my habitual denial of pain or, indeed, vulnerability, but she cannot admit this directly. She asks me leading questions like, am I truly feeling the feeling of suffering, which I find difficult to imagine. If I'm not feeling my pain, then who or what is the me in my? Instead, I announce that my partner notes often how I never complain, rarely experience side effects of medications or symptoms of an illness. By providing evidence for her claim, I try leading her to incidentally provide some reasoning. I know she thinks this hope for narrative arrangement, too, reflects repression of some deep ache. Still, I conceive of physical pain as an intellectual relief, whereby thought stops being the primary expression. I read that Asian patients require less analgesic than the European ones and wonder about what I want, my Asian patients against what I require. My twice broken nose creates a sort of suffocating zigzag, permanent purple band along my bridge, so light it is imperceptible to almost everyone. An elbow to my face in front of a group made them suddenly concerned, so I smiled to render such disquiet unnecessary. I could not assume their concern was real, which is to say, lasting. And I held, as I hold now, pain as ultimately shallow, never indicative of anything but itself. My book, you know, it's amazing how much is written about the kind of losses, the kind of griefs we can have in our families of origin and in partners. And I feel like there's a lack, or compared to what I experienced, there's a little bit of a lack about grief over friendship and the kind of relationships that we can have and how they can change. So just gonna end reading a couple about friends. The first is about the special names our friends give us, like nicknames and things like that, and the kind of codes we have for one another, terms and conditions. You call me Ho. It's short for home. A cockroach falls from a chandelier, and my bodega loyalty fluctuates in pace with the funeral's bloody nose. I've been eating trees my whole life, which usually made me more patient but more cruel. Recently, I sit on a porch that wraps around that nest, the house that used me. Any noise can be a curse to a child of chaos, silent hallways from gothic novels to twilight wind and fire songs. This unlucky, to not even be an architect and to be inundated with the prose of it all. Were we daughters spent when all hoped for sums? You call out ha. It's short for harvest. To be a child is to gather secrets, an elder to risk in transit. Once when I was recovering, covering again myself, I confused sharing for stealing, read murder into shadows until laughter came from silhouettes. I've since phased, piano bleaching the scene, becoming the fog and the pulp. You name me Ma, I know it means mine. Surviving inklings. You lose friends to both death and unusually lively withdrawal, as well as give some up, as anticipated, to misunderstanding. You leave those you assured you would not leave, and two people have left you in silence and without reason, but presumably because of your intensity, which you have long heard from friends, never lovers, for whom it was the draw. When you leave, you rarely think about those left, so perhaps it is such it is for those who leave you. Typically no story, with every tensile explanation partial, each narrative convenient and changing. You reserve the secrets of theirs you remember, pray occasionally for their families, and praise silently some whistle of generosity you witnessed. You forget the contour slowly, in the long second leaving. Neutrality, a structure you learn to glamorize. The way you have come to imagine doors as rectangular. Under limits of the boxy entry, you think of cities as grids, describe a bird as the tint of ink, forgetting that ink can be any color. Thanks so much, y'all, for being here, and thank you, Nomi, for my book copy today.
Okay, think about a question if you have one, but it's okay, you know? I had a question. Is that okay for me to start? So I'm thinking about languages, multiple. I talked a little bit about my kind of brackish water. Also, after I gave birth, like I could just kind of start speaking Vietnamese. It was like I had amnesia, and it was emerging, and I didn't know what I was saying. And elsewhere, like you've talked, I think there's a poem where it talks about like some folk, like some Korean folks who have might enter into dementia and then they like speak colonizing language, Japanese. But I'm also just thinking there's two moments in the poems that you read. There was like the me and my, and the ma and mine. And immediately that made me think about, there's like a, I don't remember where the recording is, but Ocean Vuong, because Vietnamese is such a tonal language, you can say like, ma, ma, ma. You know, like you, depending on how high or how low you take just the letters M and A, it means totally different words. And like now that I'm like relearning my first language after so many decades away from it, it's like a different, what's the word, like palette when I'm writing. And you're also a translator of Kim Hee-soon. So I don't, there's a question here. I'm just like curious, like your relationship with both languages, and how does that become its own kind of like material with which to build in your work? I'd just love to hear a little bit more.
I think it does make me think about English in a stranger way, right? Like kind of being like, well, this is a really weird language, right? And it's very playful, and to kind of be able to connect with it in a way that's admiring but also like totally bewildered is energizing for me, and also I think makes the work a little bit more able to think of language not just as this kind of tool or this like vehicle for something else, but itself this experience, and itself a sort of experiment in the moment. And I certainly feel grateful to have access to multiple languages, because even just having two, because I also have Spanish, but I feel like it's leaving me. But when you have multiple, I feel like there's a sense of like, you know that your thinking is not random, right? Because you know that you notice how you think differently in different languages, or what kinds of things you take for granted, or what kinds of like parameters you might have for feeling. And like literally, like in my family, when we say I love you, even my grandparents who don't speak any English, we say it in English. It's more comfortable. It sounds intense in Korean, you know? So it's like, Americans say it all the time. And so I think that there's like a way that you realize like, oh, language in general has a kind of power. Yeah, what was it like for you returning to it and realizing things about it in that way? Especially, I mean, tonal languages, it's not easy.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun because you're like, wait, I could put all these Legos together and they like mean all these different things. Yeah. So that was one. And I realized my parents are racist, because the words that I knew for certain things or people, certain countries, I would like raise my hand in class and be like, oh, but my parents use this word. And you could see the professor doing this thing where she's like, oh, we don't use that word. We use the one in the book. I was like, oh, shit. You know, but actually in the sympathizer, they used it. And I was like, that's the Southern dialect that reenacts the racism inherent by the people of that time, because my parents speak 1975 Vietnamese toward the Chinese. That was the attitude, and it came out linguistically. And I was like, damn, they did their research for like how they wrote the script. So I was, so that's one thing. Yeah, for me personally, but also like I'm in this new phase too, where it's like I never was literate in this language, and so literacy is a first time thing, and it's kind of fun just to play. But you're right, I actually, my spouse who's white, he's been doing the Rosetta Stone for Vietnamese, and they don't tell you the reasons why, they just like, there's lots of pictures. And so last night we were finally catching up, and he was like, how come in Vietnamese, like you always say certain categories of words before fruit, or before an animal, or before like book type objects. And I was like, oh, I never thought about it. Cause like in everyday language, we just skip that part. We just say apple, or which is actually a French word. And he was using the official Vietnamese word. We just say poem, but then he used a different word. And I was like, I don't know what that is.
Right.
So I've got like the French colonized like language embedded. But he said something that was so great. He was like, you know, I kind of like that Rosetta Stone isn't telling me why. So for me as a non-native speaker, Diana, I'm trying to figure out the relationship of these words that are used in the way that like our child is also learning Vietnamese, like from me and him and like my parents. And I feel like that's really like
that bears verisimilitude to how we acquire language.
Oh, yeah.
Like how we both probably learned English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to be needy. You have to ask questions.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah.
I didn't know, like, do you want to talk with us? Or we could continue to nerd
we
out.
We could go on and on.
I know.
But we're
it's
here
dangerous.
For you in case you have a question.
Oh, really? I mean, don't let us go into, like, poop talk, because that could really be all day. But it's true, because we were here over spring break doing a kind of Midwest part of our tour, and I, like, took a wrong turn, and it took us past the O'Hare Airport, and Cindy was like, that's where I poop.
That's my spot.
And I was like, where? Oh, I got to watch the road, you know? And then it made me think of, like, other public acts, like, unintentional but very intentional movements that had to happen. Like, I was visiting my friend who was teaching in Sendai in Japan. She's half Japanese and half Ohio. And, like, we had gone to that thing, I think, what is it, like, Namehodai, Tabehodai, where it's, like, all you can drink, all you can eat, but it's, like, 1 hour. So you got to do it real quick, you know? And then we were, like, on the train, and she's like, Diane, I have to pee. And I was like, okay, well, we're two stops away. And she's like, no, I have to pee, like, right now. So we got off. And she literally just started peeing on the platform. Which is like, that's really taboo. Like, extremely taboo. And I just did it too. Because I was like, I'll go down with you. You know, it's just kind of like immediate, like, let's be together. So I probably would have pooped with you if we were on that trip. Wait, this happened.
It's
I was camping.
Because there are fewer public restrooms than there used to be.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Wait, animals do this. Because when I went camping, you know, when you go backpacking, you dig a hole. They call it, a cat hole? Anyway, and then I was going to, sorry guys, but in lots of Asian cultures, this is part of our everyday health and we talk about it, but I was like going to the restroom and then my dogs were like, oh, we do this? And they did it next to me. And they were like, yeah, isn't this great? And then you kick dirt on it afterwards. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to use my shovel. Yeah. Okay, wow.
It comes up more than you would think, actually, because people always ask, you know, what is it like to write? What is it like to finish a poem? Or what do you feel? What is writing like? And that's what I feel writing is like. It's like taking a big shit. And sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's like diarrhea. I mean, what can you do? You just have to prepare yourself and eat your snacks and drink your water, and hopefully your body does what it needs to do.
I mean, it's kind of a distillation, but I like that it's also, like, a byproduct.
Yes, yes.
You know? I don't know. There's probably a metaphor in there, but I won't detail that. You guys still really want us to keep talking? We can do it. Okay.
Oh, you have a question.
Yeah, I'd like you to just shift the topic.
A topic shift. Culturally, how do we see the U.S. and whether it's respectful of creativity?
Well, we're both born in the U.S. We're both born in California, SoCal.
Yeah. Do you feel, like, supported artistically?
Oh, wait. Do I feel supported artistically?
Yeah.
Definitely not by my familial culture.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I switched from neuroscience to English in college. My parents were like, you already speak English.
Now you're an English professor.
I know.
You already profess English.
I know. And then when I was in grad school, they just told everybody I was doing journalism, which is not true. And then when I got a PhD, they're like, she's a doctor, but they wouldn't say what kind. So there's very much like, they just, elision, right? They just leave things out. But actually, I think like maybe after my first book, my mom was just like talking about something she saw, like a work of art, and I was so surprised. I was like, and then she was like, I think I'm starting to appreciate art. And I was like, that's great, you know. So I mean, like, that's not all Vietnamese people for sure, but it's just like my parents. But what about you?
I think that capitalism affects different countries differently, of course, and certainly having a US passport, there are things that, you know, I can't imagine about capitalism's effect on art because of that, like, power that I have. But I would say that that is the
is what affects artists more than anything, and what makes, what de-incentivizes and blocks and just makes conditions more and more difficult for writers, especially writers who don't have models for what it means to be an artist, and that is a thing, and that, you know, that it happens, and that it's even something to work toward or keep trying. And so I think that a lot of times what ends up happening is people create these sort of more horizontal, you know, less hierarchical communities where art can feel more supported and more exciting. But yeah, I think that we're all, to some extent or another, controlled by this reverence of capital, and that that makes it really hard for art to feel whole or your own.
I love that, Cindy. I think we have to close. Thank you for the question.
Thank you
yeah,
so
for your
much.
Listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.